All right, everybody, we're going to get started. My name is Luke Tillman. I'm a language evangelist for Apache Cassandra at DataStax. And today I'm going to talk about scaling out without flipping out. So really, the goal of this talk is to speak a little bit about some of the things that we do on top of building on top of relational databases, some tricks and things that we do to kind of maybe try to scale those up, whether it's to handle more load or for higher availability, that kind of stuff. And then also to introduce you then to Cassandra and kind of talk a little bit about how it's a very different approach from what you're used to with relational databases, and maybe just give you enough knowledge to be slightly dangerous with Cassandra, and also talk about how you can run a Cassandra cluster on Azure if you're interested in running a Cassandra cluster on Azure as well. So just a little bit about me real quick. So I am an evangelist, a language evangelist, which is a totally made up title. The language part of my title basically just means that I have a focus on a particular community. So in my case, it's the .NET community. And that's because prior to living this glamorous life of an evangelist, I was a developer for a really long time. So about 15 years writing applications, primarily web apps on top of relational databases. And most of the last 10 has been in the .NET space. But prior to that, Java, PHP, recently a little Node.js, that kind of stuff. So a bunch of other languages as well. I also got a chance to present at the Cassandra Summit in 2014. So this was back in September. This is our big like users conference where we had something like 2,000 attendees come to San Francisco. And I got to co-present the talk with an Azure evangelist from Microsoft, which was kind of cool. But I tell you that so that I can show you this picture of what I think most people at the big open source Cassandra Summit. Cassandra's a big Apache project. And people were kind of skeptical of Microsoft being one of the presenters at a big open source conference like this. Historically, they have not always had the greatest reputation when it comes to open source software. But it's been kind of cool just since that talk in September, like the last 6 months, the announcements coming out of Microsoft, and you actually saw this slide earlier in Shahid's deck. This is just crazy, some of the stuff that's coming out of there. So I'll give you two examples. Open sourcing of the .NET framework, for example. You know, me being a .NET developer, I was pretty pumped about that. And then they also announced they were going to do Windows support for Docker containers, so they were going to contribute to the Docker project. So just two examples of many things that have come out of Microsoft in the last 6 months. So kind of a cool time, kind of cool to see them like turn the corner and really start to embrace open source software and communities and whatnot. So I'm going to try and go fast because we're delayed, so we'll try to move pretty quick. But I'm going to stop for questions along the way. So this is kind of the agenda. We'll talk sort of about the problem, like some things that we typically do on relational databases to try and scale. Introduce Cassandra, talk a little bit about how it's different. Talk about some of the power that Cassandra puts in your hands as a developer to kind of tune some dials and decide sort of how available versus consistent you want to be. Then we'll talk about how it's different from relational databases, so SQL, the query language, how it compares to SQL, as well as data modeling, which is also very, very different in Cassandra. And then lastly, we'll talk about Cassandra and Azure together, like how do I actually run a Cassandra on a Cassandra cluster in Azure. So let's talk about the problem. So we have a like sort of a typical setup like this for a web application. You know, maybe we've got a web server and some sort of application server that's running background tasks, and they're both talking to some sort of relational database on the back end. So pretty common thing that we would have if we're building sort of a web application. And as developers, when we build these things, a lot of times in the back of our heads, we're thinking, so how can I, how am I going to scale this thing out? You know, all of us want to build like the next big thing, especially if you're a startup. You're trying to build the next big thing that's going to catch on. Users are going to love it. And as a developer, you know, you're always thinking, okay, how am I going to make this thing highly available so that I don't have any downtime? And also, how am I going to scale this out when the users actually show up and this thing is as popular as I think it's going to be? And so when we're talking about the app tier up there, usually that's not too terribly hard to scale out, especially in this day and age of cloud infrastructure. It's pretty easy to like spin up new instances of our app tier, and our app tier tends to be stateless as well, right? So we're shoving all that state back into the relational database. So the app tier itself, you know, it's pretty easy to spin up some new web servers, maybe throw a load balancer in front of it, that kind of thing, round robin the traffic. Not too terribly painful. But at the end of the day, we're still talking to that single relational database on the back end. And so this can be a single, not only a single point of failure as far as availability goes, but this can also be a bottleneck too. So when we start to get into scale and we start to get into traffic, you know, and we really get a popular app, that can be a bottleneck as well. So let's talk about some ways that we actually try to scale our relational database. So the first thing that we typically do is we scale up. So buy a bigger SAN, buy more memory, buy a faster processor, whatever. And the thing with scaling up is that can get you for a little while. That can get you there. But it gets really expensive. As you get into more like exotic hardware configurations, you get off kind of commodity hardware. This can get expensive super, super quick. So another thing that we do, like anybody ever seen a query like this, like with like 16 joins and like, you know, or maybe like an ORM generated it? Like I know at my last company, it was like ORMs generating crap like this. So you know, you got this query and it starts to perform really poorly. And so one of the things that we'll do, one of the tricks we'll do when we have a query with lots of joins to sort of improve the performance of the query is we'll denormalize. So we'll take and instead of doing all these joins at query time, we'll take and we'll create a table that's actually meant just to service that query. And then at write time, we'll actually write our table into the denormalized view that we created so that we can do a really simple query like a select star from our denormalized view. And that's typically a way cheaper query, so we're kind of paying the cost at write time so that then we can do a really simple read come read time. And this can help us scale some of our reads or some of our queries that aren't performing great. Another thing that we'll do that's typically for high availability is when we do this first, or higher availability with relational databases, is we'll add replication. So we'll have a primary server that we write all our data to, and then we chain some replicas to it, and that's there in case the primary fails, then we can fail over to the backup or fail over to one of the replicas and be back up and running with one of the replicas as kind of our primary. And so this is all fine and good. Usually what we have is we have some sort of failover process watching it. So this could be like an automatic thing that's watching for the database to go down, or this could be like a manual process where the database goes down and somebody actually has to push a button to fail it over. And the problem with this is that like when the database goes down, whether it's an automatic process or a manual process, we still have downtime, right? So there's still going to be some period of time, even if we have a process to detect it, where the database is going to be down and our site's going to be down. We're not going to be able to accept traffic and whatnot. And if we do this as an automatic process, a lot of times what we'll do is we'll build something else, like something to monitor the failover. Because if this is an automatic process, like we don't want the failover process to go down and us not know about it. So like we got to build something to like watch the failover as well. And then another thing we'll do then, once we kind of have this replicated setup, is maybe we'll, to scale out our reads, you know, we have a read-heavy workload, maybe we'll start sending our write requests to the primary, and then we'll start routing our read requests to the replicas. So we'll start sending reads to the slave servers. You know, sometimes this is called master-slave replication, if you ever heard that term before. And so when you do this, where you route the read requests to the replicas, a lot of times this is called read replication. So now I've got write requests going to the master, and I've got read requests going to the replicas. But the thing is, we're not going to beat the laws of physics. So there's going to be a lag between the time that I write data to my primary and the time that I get data at my replica. I can actually read data at my replicas. So this can turn into a really weird scenario where like some of the things that you kind of are used to taking for granted in your relational database, like for example, being able to read your own writes, because of that replication lag, now you've kind of introduced eventual consistency into your system, and some of the stuff that you built on originally, some of the assumptions you built on with your relational database aren't exactly maybe holding true anymore. Now, we still got that single primary that we're writing to, so that can be a bottleneck if we got lots of writes, if we have a write-heavy volume, a write-heavy workload. And so typically what we'll do if we want to scale out writes then is we'll shard our data. So anybody done sharding before, where you pick a shard key, and so here's an example of user's data, maybe like sharded by username, and so we've got, this is actually an example of a really terrible shard key. So picking a shard key is actually really important when you divide your data like this. So you can imagine like our A through F shard might be way bigger than our U through Z shard. And if we get the shard key wrong, then it's usually like a manual process to have to like move the data around and rebalance it and that kind of thing. And then we also have to have some other component, like a router component or something. And this could be in our code, or this could be an actual appliance. Like there's some vendors that actually sell appliances that will sit between your app servers and sit in front of your database servers and do the routing of requests, because we have to be able to route to the right shard when we do a query or when we do a write, something like that. And so now the thing with sharding is that now things that we take for granted in a relational database, like being able to do joins or transactions or aggregations, that's really hard to do across shards. Like if you have to do a query across shards, and the secondary indexes that you get that are really nice in a SQL database, if you need to do a query on a secondary index, but it's across shards, now you got to do this like scatter gather where you like go query all the shards and pull back the data and kind of put it together in your application. So some of the other benefits that we get with a relational database have also kind of fallen by the wayside. And so then maybe we add, you know, we want our shards to be high availability or higher availability also, so we do some sharding and some replication. And at this point, we're probably denormalizing too at that point, right? And we got our failover process, and now it's also watching, like, not just one master, but it's watching four masters. And we got our thing that's monitoring the failover to make sure that, you know, the failover process doesn't fail. And don't forget, we got to route our read requests to the replicas, and our write requests go to the write servers. And don't forget about replication lag, so you might not be able to read your own writes. And by the time you're, like, done setting up something like this, you might look like that guy, where you're just kind of like, oh my God, there has to be a simpler way to do this, right? This is like a whole lot of complexity. And I'm not saying that you can't do this. You absolutely can do this. There are plenty of companies that do this and get it right. So like a good example would be Facebook, right? Facebook, one of the biggest sites in the world, and they're on MySQL, and they've figured out somehow how to manage to make this work. But you're probably not Facebook. You probably don't have the same engineering people that they have. So you might start thinking, okay, there's got to be a better way or an easier way to do this than replication and sharding and all these moving parts and all these things that can fail. So let's talk about Cassandra, because Cassandra is very different. Some of these frustrations is where some of the NoSQL movement came from, frustrations with things like this. And so I'm going to introduce you to Cassandra and talk a little bit about how it works and kind of how it's different than that approach to scaling. So Cassandra is a linearly scaling and fault-tolerant distributed database, which is like ridiculous mouthful to say. So we'll break each part down and kind of I'll explain to you what I mean by like each part of that. So first distributed, it's fully distributed. So you got data and it's spread around multiple nodes in a cluster. And so all nodes are equal. There's no single point of failure. There's only one node type, a Cassandra node. There's none of this master-slave stuff. It's a peer-to-peer architecture. And it runs on commodity hardware as well. So there's no like big, humongous, exotic configuration boxes that you need to buy. Everything runs on commodity hardware also. It's also linearly scaling. So what does that mean? That means if you have more data, you just add more nodes to your cluster. And it also means that if you have more throughput that you need, so you need to service more read or write transactions in your cluster, you also just add more nodes to your cluster. And it's kind of cool because its scaling is very, very predictable. So if you look at if you look at the scaling graphs from Cassandra, if you sort of double the number of nodes in your cluster, you're going to double your write throughput. It's very predictable sort of looking graph. Also say it's fault tolerant. So what does that mean? That means if nodes go down, and we all know, especially in cloud environments, like machines fail. So if nodes go down, your database isn't down. It also means if you're in a multi-data center setup that you can lose an entire data center and not go down. You can still stay online. And multi-DC is actually one of the cool things about Cassandra. It was baked in from the start. Like not a lot of other sort of data stores or database products can kind of talk about multi-DC the way Cassandra can. So what do I mean when I say multi-DC? So fully replicated, so all your data centers, and you can have as many as you want, will have full copies of your data. And what you typically have is a client that writes local, and then the data is replicated across the WAN, and you get to configure a replication factor per data center. And replication factor, we're going to talk about it in a few slides, but basically it just means how many copies of your data are there. So you could say, you know, I want 3 copies in my US data center and 5 copies in my Europe data center and 6 copies in my Mars data center or wherever else you wanted to run a data center. So we can't talk about a distributed system like Cassandra without talking about the CAP theorem. So I don't know if everybody knows the CAP theorem, but CAP theorem basically is just a limit on what distributed systems can do. So CAP stands for consistency, availability, and partition tolerance, and basically says that it's impossible in a distributed system, once you have your data spread along many nodes like this, it's impossible to have all 3 of those things, and people will tell you that in the real world, network partitions happen, so you have nodes that can't talk to each other from time to time. Networks fail, they're not reliable. And so really, you have to choose partition tolerance. So really, you get to choose, will I be consistent or available when partitioned, when there's a network partition? And Cassandra is an AP system. So Cassandra favors availability at the expense of consistency, and it's eventually consistent. And so I'm going to explain like this idea of trading off consistency for availability. I'm going to kind of explain what I mean and how Cassandra kind of puts you in control of trading consistency for availability, and also this idea of being eventually consistent, which can be very scary as a developer who's used to relational databases. Okay, so with great power comes great responsibility. So what are these What are the powers that you as the developer have in your hands to to kind of tune this idea of fault tolerance? We said Cassandra is fault tolerant, so it can, nodes can go down and your data can still, your database can still stay up. So there's really two that you kind of have at your disposal. One is set on the server side and one is set on the client side. So server side, we mentioned this one, replication factor. So again, this just means how many copies of your data are there. And you set this again on the server side. So when you create a key space in Cassandra, and a key space is basically if you have a relational database experience, it's the same thing as a database. So it's just a collection of tables, essentially. So it's a database from SQL Server or MySQL, that kind of thing. And you'll set that when you create your key space on the server side. Other one's called consistency level. And this, if you're a developer, this is the one that you will interact with the most. So you get to set this on the client side, actually in your client code, your client application code. And you get to do this for any given read or write against the cluster. So you kind of get to pick and choose which parts of your application use one consistency level versus which parts might use another one. And we'll talk about why you might choose to use one versus another. So let's talk about replication factor first. So again, just means how many copies of your data should there be? So you see example, client writing A, the A node gets a copy, the B node gets a copy, and the C node gets a copy for a replication factor of 3. So 3 is a really common RF in Cassandra. A lot of people run with 3. So you'll see all my examples, I'm using RF of 3 for all the examples here. That's replication factor. Consistency level. So this is set client side, and this basically just means how many replicas do I need to hear from before I can acknowledge to the client, like, yes, we got your write, or in the case of a read, if you're doing a read operation, this means how many replicas do I need to get an answer from before I give the answer back to the client, before I say, yep, here's the data that you asked for. So I'm going to show you an example of two of the most popular ones just to kind of illustrate what it is, and hopefully it'll be a little bit clearer because I know that could be confusing at first. So consistency level of 1, like the name sort of implies, means I need to hear from one replica. So see, client writes A, their A node gets its copy, and then it responds back to the client, yep, got your data. Now I put those dashed lines there to indicate to you that just because you write with a consistency level of 1 doesn't mean Cassandra doesn't still honor your replication factor that you configured. So B and C nodes there are still going to get a copy of that data. We just don't have to wait for those nodes to respond before we respond to the client, yep, the write was good. The other one is called quorum. So this is the other most popular one. So quorum, if you've never heard the term before, basically just means a majority of nodes, so a majority of replicas. So in this case, if I have 3 replicas, replication factor of 3, a majority would be 2 out of the 3. So client writes A at quorum. You can see the A node gets its copy, the B node gets a copy and responds back. And then at that point, we can respond to the client because we know 2 out of the 3 nodes have copies of the data. And again, dashed line to indicate, hey, your C node's still going to get a copy there. We're just not waiting on it to respond before we send the acknowledgement back to the client. So this applies to both reads and writes, so both inserts, updates, and selects if you're doing reads. And you get to set it on each individual query, so you set it on a query-by-query kind of basis in Cassandra. And so this is a list of some other popular replication factors, and there's really, or I'm sorry, consistency levels. And there's really two things that I want to point out on this slide. So local one and local quorum, if you're in a multi-data center setup, which a lot of people do multi-DC with Cassandra, you're probably going to use those because you don't want to be waiting on responses from replicas in another data center. Like, that's going to be really, really slow. So most of the time, if you're in multi-DC, you're going to use local one or local quorum instead of one in quorum. And then all. So all is available as well. I like to refer to this as the super paranoid consistency level. Don't use this. Like, I mean, it's there, but you won't actually use it. At least I hope you won't use it. And I'm going to explain why. So now we're going to talk like why you would choose one consistency level versus another. And I'm going to point out like what would happen in some of these scenarios if you tried to do it with all. So consistency level and speed. So how many replicas you have to wait for a response is going to affect how fast you can read and write data both to and from your cluster. So you can see this example here, client reading A at quorum. We get one node that responds pretty quickly, 5 microseconds. We get another one that's pretty quick, 12 microseconds. And then this third one over here, for some reason, it takes forever. It takes 300 microseconds to respond, which is like an eternity, right, in computer science terms. And so we're able to respond to the client in 12 microseconds because we only had to wait for quorum, 2 out of the 3 nodes. So we were only as slow as basically the second slowest node that gave us a response. Now, you can imagine if we had done this read at consistency level of 1, waiting on 1 replica, we would have been even faster, right? We would have been able to respond in 5 microseconds because that would have been the fastest one to give us an answer. But if we had used the super paranoid consistency level of all, we would have been way slower. So we would have been 300 microsecond acknowledgement. So we would have been waiting on that last one to respond before we could have sent an acknowledgement back to the client. So if you choose a higher consistency level like quorum or all, you're going to get slower reads and writes than if you choose a lower consistency level like 1, for example. Consistency level also affects availability. So this idea of trading consistency for availability in the CAP theorem, this is kind of what we were talking about. So here's an example, client reading A again at quorum. And this time, one of the nodes that would normally respond to the query is down. It's having a hard drive failure, it's getting rebooted, it has an OS upgrade, we're upgrading Cassandra. I don't know, machines go down, right? Sometimes it's planned, sometimes it's not. So you can see because we read at quorum, we were still able to hear from 2 out of the 3 nodes in two out of the 3 replicas in our cluster. And so we were still able to respond to the client. Now, if we had done this read at consistency level of 1, then we would have also been OK. We would have had 1 out of the 2 replicas would have still been able to respond. But if we had done this at all, the super paranoid consistency level, we would have actually had to send a failure back to the client. We would have to say, sorry, one of the replicas we need to hear from is down. So if you choose a higher consistency level like all or quorum, you're going to be less available. If you choose a lower consistency level like 1, you're going to be more available. You can tolerate more nodes essentially going down. The last thing to talk about is this idea of eventual consistency and the consistency level. So we said Cassandra is an AP system that is eventually consistent. So from time to time, nodes may disagree about the value. So you may get a node that hasn't heard the latest update or hasn't heard the latest insert write, something like that. So it may have like slightly out of date information. And so what you need to know about Cassandra is that when you do a write in Cassandra, every column value gets a timestamp. And when nodes disagree on the value like this, that timestamp is what's used to sort of resolve the conflict. So Cassandra uses what's called last write wins semantics, which basically is just a fancy way of saying whichever one has the latest timestamp is the one that's going to win. So same example again, client reading A at quorum. And you can see one node says A equals 2 with a newer timestamp. Another one says A equals 1 with an older timestamp. And we actually return A equals 2 to the client because last write wins, whatever has the newest timestamp wins. Now you can imagine if we had done this read at consistency level of 1 instead of quorum, it's possible that the first node to respond to our query there could have been the one with the older data. So it's possible if we had done this read at consistency level of 1 that we would have read stale data. So what consistency level you choose will affect whether or not you can read stale data from your cluster. So keep that in mind when you're choosing a consistency level. You know, you may have parts of your application where that's totally fine. They don't need to read the latest value always. You may have other parts where you need stronger consistency and you need to always read the latest, be able to read the latest value. So you might use stronger consistency level then. And so the other thing I want to mention, and this will be on my slide share afterwards if anyone's interested in the link, but there's a great webinar, Christos. He works for Netflix. Netflix is a huge user of Cassandra. They use it for something like 90% of their internal database use cases. And he did a really awesome webinar called Eventual Consistency Does Not Equal Hopeful Consistency. Because as developers, we hear this term like eventual consistency, and we're like, well, what the heck does eventual mean? Like, are we talking like seconds or minutes or hours or days? Like, how eventual is eventual? And he did this webinar where he talks about some tests they did internal to Netflix where they saw, okay, what, you know, how eventual is eventual? And what they found was generally we're talking like on the order of milliseconds or maybe tens of milliseconds in a normally functioning Cassandra cluster where there aren't any sort of network issues or anything going on. And even between data centers, you're talking like tens or maybe hundreds of milliseconds depending on how far apart essentially they are. You know, if you're talking like West Coast to Europe, okay, that might be some pretty big latency. But West Coast to East Coast, like maybe 100 millisecond latency. So in a normally functioning Cassandra cluster, not as eventual as you might think. And so if this concept scares you a little bit, like I definitely recommend you check out that webinar. It talks a lot about getting used to the idea of eventual consistency. And remember, we had it in our relational database too, right? Like once we added replication, like couldn't even read our own writes anymore. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about sort of the difference between Cassandra and relational databases as far as SQL goes. So let's talk about difference. So first thing I want to mention is video sharing site, killer video. So I built this demo site. It was one of the first things that I did when I joined DataStax. If you're looking for a good example of data modeling, bonus points if you're a C-sharp guy, love the shirt. So bonus points if you want to see example C-sharp code or JavaScript code that talks to Cassandra, that kind of thing. There's a live demo available at killervideo.com. It's running in Azure on a DataStax Enterprise cluster. And it's open source, so it's on my GitHub, Apache 2 license. If you just want to see schema examples, like how does a SQL schema compare to an SQL schema, this is a really good example because if I say YouTube to most of you, like pretty much everybody knows what YouTube is. They kind of like know, okay, like if I were building YouTube and I were going to build it on a relational database, this is how I might do the data model. Okay, now let's look at what it's like to do it with Cassandra. So it's kind of a well-known kind of problem space. So it's usually a good thing to throw at developers and say, hey, check this out if you want some sample code or some sample schema. So I'm going to show you some of the examples I'm going to show you in the slides. They're pulled directly from this project. So okay, so data structures in Cassandra. So Cassandra, you can see key space, tables, partitions, and rows. And so key space and tables should look really familiar to you if you have relational experience. It's the same thing. Key space is the same as a database or a schema in Oracle if you've got Oracle experience. Where it kind of starts to break down a little bit is partitions and rows. So partitions, they can have one row in them, be narrow, and that looks a lot like sort of what you picture a relational database looking like. But they can also be wide. So you can also have wide partitions, partitions with many rows in them. And that's where that can be a little hard to get your brain around as a relational developer. So I'll show you examples of both. So here's what it looks like to create a table in Cassandra. So this is an example of SQL. So create table statement, we're creating a videos table to store our videos that people are going to upload to the site. You can see it's got column names, it's got data types, it looks a lot like SQL, which is a good thing because you get to use a lot of your knowledge from SQL, but also a bad thing, and maybe I'll mention that in a little bit. It's also got a primary key. So primary key uniquely identifies a row just like it does in a relational database. The thing to know is the first part of your primary key is called your partition key in Cassandra. So this in this example here, the first and only part, the first and only column in our primary key is the partition key. So why do I tell you that? It's because the partition key is what actually determines node placement in Cassandra. So if you're wondering, like, how does data get distributed around to the various nodes in the ring, it's this partition key that actually is used to determine that. So look at pretty animations. So you can think of this conceptually as, as one table. Like, you can think of it as, these rows that are all conceptually together in one table. But what's actually going on under the scenes is that each of these partitions is getting spread amongst all the nodes in your cluster. So how does that work? If we look at a single partition key, like let's look at the value for a single row in the table. So we got this value, this GUID, this UUID value. And what Cassandra does is it takes that value, runs it through a consistent hashing function. In Cassandra, by default, it's the MURMUR3 hashing function. And out comes some value. So like MURMUR3 says A, and so Cassandra knows, oh, I need to go talk to the A node, for example. And then data is then replicated to according to your replication factor to other nodes in the ring. And basically just the simplest replication strategy it uses is really dumb. It basically just finds the next two nodes around the ring and puts copies there. Now, if you've ever worked with a hashing function in code before, you know that, okay, like this isn't real. Like if I put that value in, I don't actually get A. What I really get out if I hash something like this UUID is a 128-bit number. So I get some really ugly number that probably looks like something like that up in the right-hand corner. And so if you want to think of Cassandra conceptually, you can think of Cassandra as basically a giant hash ring or a giant, sometimes it's called a token ring. And each node in Cassandra owns a range of hashes, where each node owns a bucket of hashes. And so when we take that value, that video ID, we run it through the hashing function, we get this 128-bit number, we can figure out which range, essentially, that number falls into, and thus which node we should go talk to, because each node owns a range of tokens. Make sense? Okay. So that's partition key. So if you have more than one part to your primary key, so if you do a primary key with more than one column, the second part of your primary key is called clustering columns. And so clustering columns are there to order your rows inside of a partition. So when I said that partitions can be narrow, that was the video's example that I showed you. Partitions can also be wide. They can have many rows in them. And when you use clustering columns like this, this is how you get wide rows. And I'll show you kind of conceptually what that looks like on the next slide. But here you can see we got like a comments by video table. So like our users, when users post videos to the site, we're going to let other users comment on them, just like YouTube. And so you can see our primary key here is video ID and comment ID. So we're saying, store all the comments for a video, for any given video, together in a partition, which we just learned a partition basically determines which node it's going to live on. So store all the comments for a video together on a single machine, on a single node, and then order them inside of that partition by comment ID. Now, comment ID is type time UUID. So if you've never seen one of these before, and I know I had never seen one because there isn't really an analog in .NET. There isn't something in the BCL of .NET that was a time UUID type. So I was like, what is that? Time UUID is basically a UUID or a GUID if you're a Microsoft person that has a timestamp embedded in it. So when you generate a time UUID, it's a completely valid unique identifier. It's just got a timestamp component that you use to generate it. And so when you sort by a time UUID, it's got this kind of cool property that when you sort by it, you're actually sorting in time order. So you're actually sorting it essentially in the timestamp that's embedded inside of it. So basically this table here, we're saying, okay, for the videos, for the comments for a video inside of a partition, we're gonna order them by time, essentially the time that they were created. So we're actually doing with clustering order by comment ID descending, which is basically a way to specify a default ordering for the rows in the partition, because we're gonna always probably get the latest comments first when we show them on in our UI. And so we're saying order them by comment ID descending, which is basically by time descending, because we're gonna usually get the latest ones. So conceptually, what does this kind of look like? So the use of clustering columns, this is where this term wide row comes from. So if you've ever heard Cassandra called a wide row store or a wide column store or something like that, it's kind of old terminology for basically wide partitions. So you can see we've got like a single partition here. We're looking at a single video ID. And then we've got the comments kind of laid out next to them. And I even pulled out, you probably can't see it in the back, but heck, you might not be able to see it in the front with this projector, but you kind of pull out the timestamp component. So basically the newest comment is first, and then next to it on disk are going to be the older comments as I go down the partition. So how do I insert and update data? This should look really familiar to you. If you have SQL experience, it's an insert and an update statement. The thing to know about inserts and updates with Cassandra is that both are functionally equivalent. So Cassandra, and because this is kind of a shorter talk, I don't go into the read path and the write path of Cassandra, but basically Cassandra doesn't do a read before a write, and there's none of this idea of constraints going on. This is one of the reasons Cassandra is really, really fast at writing data, really fast at like ingesting lots of data really quickly. Since it doesn't do a read before a write, and there's no constraints like a relational database, insert and update are basically the same thing. So if you try to like insert some data that already exists, it'll just overwrite it. Or if you try to update some data that doesn't exist yet, you won't get like a, you know, hey, primary key violation, that doesn't exist sort of thing. It will just insert it for you. It's basically the same thing either way. So keep that in mind when doing inserts and updates. You can obviously also delete data from Cassandra. So one way to do that is TTLs. So you can do an insert, and you can say using TTL, and you specify it in seconds, and Cassandra will automatically expire that data for you, basically. You also have a delete statement. So a delete statement, again, looks just like SQL delete statement. The one difference with a delete statement in Cassandra is if you want to delete just certain columns in a row, you can do that. So you could say delete X, Y, and Z, you know, those being the columns in your table, from this table if you wanted to just delete certain column values as opposed to the whole row. But if you don't specify a column list, it just deletes the whole row just like you're used to from SQL. Last thing is, how do I get data out? So querying. So again, select statement also looks very similar to SQL. Now the thing to know about queries in Cassandra is that queries in Cassandra tries to limit you to things that will actually scale in a big distributed system. So some of the things that you're used to being able to do with SQL, you will not be able to do with SQL. So an example would be joins. You know, I gave that example of how we denormalize, you know, in our SQL database for performance. because joins can be really expensive. Well, joins, when you're talking to many nodes in a cluster, like get even more expensive when there's network latency and stuff like that involved. So Cassandra won't let you do joins. It also says that you should always specify a partition key, a value for the partition key, and then optionally you can specify values for your clustering columns. And so you might say, okay, well, why does Cassandra limit me to where I have to always specify a value for the partition key? And so if you think about it for a second and kind of what we know about how partition keys work, remember, partition keys determine which node we need to go talk to for a given piece of data. And so if we let you do a query where you just said, didn't include a value for the partition key, Cassandra would actually have to go talk to every node in the cluster to find out if that data actually existed on one of those nodes. And while that might be okay in like a 3-node cluster, like it probably wouldn't be great, but it would be okay in a 30-node cluster or a 300-node cluster or a 3,000-node cluster. That's definitely a recipe for failure. So Cassandra will try to push you in this direction. And if you try to do something that's probably not going to scale, you try to do a query that's sort of not good for a big distributed system, it's actually going to like throw errors at you. And you might get frustrated by it if you don't realize that it puts these restrictions on you. So how do I data model if Cassandra is going to force me to do this sort of, I have to query by partition key and optionally then the clustering columns? So the answer, the biggest tool that you'll use, and this is the biggest difference between data modeling in relational databases and data modeling with Cassandra, is denormalizing. So we are certainly taught as relational developers, like third normal form or higher, no duplicating data, like it's like drilled into our heads, forever and ever. And so the thing with Cassandra is you're basically going to build tables. You're going to start with your queries. If you start like with your application workflows, like how am I going to actually need to access this data on the site, then I'm going to actually build tables to answer those queries with the correct partition key and optionally then clustering columns to be able to sort of run queries against those tables. So you end up a lot of times with this kind of almost table per query sort of pattern where you build a different table for every query that you need to run in the system. And then at write time, when you need to actually insert data, you're going to denormalize at write time, write your data potentially into multiple tables so that then come read time, you can go do reads directly against those tables and read it out directly, sort of the way that you need to access it in your application. And so disk is cheap now. So a lot of times, keeping multiple copies of your data in the past was kind of a non-starter because, disk was super expensive, especially when relational databases were like first getting started. These days, disk is like one of the cheapest of all the resources essentially we get to use, particularly in the cloud. And writes in Cassandra are fast. So like I said, Cassandra is really, really good at ingesting lots of data really quickly. It's sort of a write-optimized database. People will refer to it as that a lot. And so you're kind of taking advantage of the fact that Cassandra is fast at writes so that then come read time, you can kind of read stuff exactly how you need it. So let me give you an example. So here's killer video again. This is two use cases related to users. So user shows up at the site, and they're probably going to want to log in. So we're going to look up the user by their email address is one query we need to run. And then we've also got this part of the site where we're going to kind of show like the basic profile information, so the user's name and their email address and that kind of information. And in that case, we're probably going to look the user up by ID. We're going to query them by ID. And so let's talk about in a relational database, like kind of how we would model this. So we probably have a single users table, and it would have a primary key of ID. And that would be enough to basically be able to do our second query there. We'd be able to look users up by ID efficiently. That would be all fine and good. Then we probably just slap a secondary index on the email column. And now all of a sudden we can do efficient queries on the email by email as well. So that kind of takes care of our first query that we need to run. So that's kind of how we would do it in a relational database. The problem is, maybe all of a sudden our app gets super popular and all our user data won't fit on a single machine anymore. Or we decide, it's really important that people actually be able to log into our site. Like that database, that relational database, that single point of failure, that's really bad. Like if that ever goes down, people won't be able to log in and we're screwed. So you might start thinking, okay, maybe I should move this over to something more highly available, or maybe I need to spread this data amongst more nodes in the cluster. So maybe you think about using Cassandra. What would this look like in Cassandra? This is sort of what the data model might look like in Cassandra. So again, we're going to start with our queries and we're going to build tables to answer those queries. So you can see on the right, the users table there probably looks pretty much identical to what it would look like in a relational database. You can see it's got a primary key of user ID for being able to look users up by ID. And then the table on the left, the user credentials table, it's got a primary key of email address so that we can do queries by email address. And you can see there's data duplicated between both tables. So password is in both tables, user ID is in both tables. We didn't duplicate everything, but there is data duplicated between the two. And really, this is kind of the tool that you will use the most. It will feel wrong at first, especially if you have relational database experience, but this is kind of how you data model with Cassandra. This is typically the tool you use the most. All right, so last thing I want to talk about is Cassandra and Azure. So first thing, I was going to do this as two slides. So I was going to do one for the DataStax drivers and one for like the Azure SDKs. And the funny thing is, they were so similar that it was like, why not just put them on one slide? So first thing to know, DataStax drivers, all the DataStax drivers are open source, as are all the Azure SDKs. Funny enough, they even use the same open source license, so they're both Apache 2 licensed. You can find them on GitHub, so the GitHub links are there. Another thing, and this was in some of the earlier slides, there is a huge overlap between languages. So I'm a .NET guy, and a lot of people think Azure is just for .NET. That is absolutely not true. People run all kinds of languages on it. In fact, there was a guy from a startup up here talking about Python on it. But typically what you would expect, Java, PHP, Ruby, Python, you know, kind of the typical languages. DataStax also has drivers for all of those languages. And in addition to that, it also has DataStax, we also offer a C++ driver. So if you're programming in C++, we have that for you as well. And then platforms, you can run Cassandra on Windows or Linux, and you can also have Cassandra Linux or Windows VMs, which is kind of nice. Now, if you are using Cassandra 2.1 or greater, so that's sort of the latest version of Cassandra that's out there right now, you can absolutely run it on Windows in production. If you do, it's kind of in a beta period right now, so we would love your feedback. Like, tell us where it's still broken or where it performs poorly and whatnot. If you're a little gun-shy and you don't want to kind of try that out, we still recommend that you run on Linux for production deployments, especially if you're using a version less than 2.1. If you're just doing development, you can absolutely run on either platform. You can run on Windows or Linux, and it'll be totally fine. In version 3.0, which is hopefully coming in the next few months, hopefully Windows and Linux will basically have performance parity when it comes to which platform you run Cassandra on. So Cassandra is a JVM application, if you don't know, so you can really run it on either. Oh, and the other thing to mention, of course, and this stat got mentioned earlier, over 20% of Azure VMs actually run Linux. So like that example, Killer Video app, like if you go to the live site in your browser, that's running on a DataStax Enterprise cluster that is running on Linux. You know, so thing to know about deploying Cassandra, and this is true just generally speaking, deploying Cassandra, not just on Azure, but IOPS are super important. So a lot of times we tell people, like, one of the biggest decisions you will make as far as deploying Cassandra, like that will impact your performance, is what type of disks you decide to deploy on. Like, and if you decide to deploy on a SAN and then call us, like, someone might yell at you, I don't know. That's actually the absolute wrong way to do it, is to deploy on a SAN. We typically tell people to do ephemeral storage, so preferably SSDs, if you can do locally attached SSDs. But definitely don't use a SAN, because I mean, with a SAN, you've basically taken the distributed nature of Cassandra and introduced a single point of failure and a single bottleneck. Like, you've introduced shared storage behind it, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Kind of goes against the architecture of Cassandra. So when running in Azure, what should you kind of choose to do? You kind of have two main choices, and you're kind of trading off one thing for the other when you're making the choice. So you can do A7 instances. These have really high IOPS limits, and you can map your disks to Azure Blob Storage. So this is sort of a shared storage solution. You can get pretty decent performance from this. But your other option, like I said, the way we typically tell people to run it is local attached storage. So you can get G3 or G4 instances. These are some of the newer instance types available from Azure. These have local SSDs, and they're ephemeral. So if this machine, like if your machine dies, your node dies, and it can't be resurrected, like that disk is basically gone. So the trade-off really here is, do you want more safety by using shared storage, where if a machine crashes, I can just spin up a new instance and reattach the volumes, the disks that were in shared storage, versus less performance in that case, or do you want more performance? Because you'll definitely get better performance typically on the SSDs. You just will have less safety. So if a node crashes, you're going to have to probably replace it and have it rebuild. Now the thing with Cassandra is, it's pretty resilient. Nodes can go down and be replaced, and the data will be streamed from other replicas. So you may decide that it's an acceptable sort of amount of risk to take that a node will crash and you want the extra performance that SSDs get. There's also some kind of other tricky things you can do, and I have to thank Matt Kennedy, who's in the back of the room, for giving me these ideas. So if you want to talk Azure storage, he's the guy to talk to. You could take advantage of multi-DC replication. So we said Cassandra does multiple data centers, and it's pretty good at it. You could run two data centers inside the actual same physical data center, so they could really just be logical data centers inside the same Azure region or whatnot. And you could have one that's backed by SSDs and one that's backed by Azure Blob Storage. And that way you kind of get safety from one of your clusters and you got the performance from the other side of the cluster. The other thing you could do if you just want to utilize Azure Storage is you could do frequent snapshotting of your SSDs to Azure Storage. Snapshot is basically just a backup utility inside, as a way to back up your Cassandra instances. So you could do that as well and throw those backups onto shared storage as well. So there's two ways to kind of spin up a Cassandra cluster. So first thing is a scripted setup. So this is like PowerShell and Bash scripts that you can take and customize and kind of play with the configurations. And you'll have much finer control over how many VMs to spin up and what the passwords are and what their configurations are and how many disks should be striped and all these little different things that you may want to play with. So if you need this sort of finer control over how the VMs are configured and whatnot, you might want to take this approach. I put a link in the slides to some instructions along with the actual scripts themselves if you're interested in taking and sort of doing things this way. The other really simple way to do, the other way, which is actually way simpler than doing that, so if you just want like the easy button way for spinning up a Cassandra cluster, there is the Azure Preview Portal. So there's this marketplace in the Azure Preview Portal. It's portal.azure.com is the address. And if you search for DataStax in the marketplace there, you'll find two things there. So you'll find a DataStax Enterprise cluster, which will give you 8 nodes. So it's for production use. This will spin up 8 nodes for you and also 1 node for Ops Center. Or you'll also see something called the Sandbox. So it's just a single node deployment where it'll spin up a single node for you if you just want something to sort of play around with and kind of test and goof off with. You also have that option as well. So when you use the Azure Preview Portal, basically all you do is you go in, search for DataStax, click on it, and then you just configure like what type of virtual machines you want, like what size of virtual machines you want. So I talked about G versus A series in Cassandra. Basically, you have to pick which ones you want to use and give it some passwords, like what do you want the Linux admin passwords to be and the Linux admin username to be, and then you click a button, and that's it. And it will go off and spin up 8 nodes for you along with an extra node, an extra VM with Ops Center on it. And so you get 8 nodes, you click a button. I mean, what's easier than that? VM for Ops Center. And once you've, either way, like whether you do the scripted command line setup, where you're kind of in more control versus like the super easy push button method. If you don't want all 8 VMs, by the way, after it spins up the 8 VMs for your cluster, if that's like too many and you just need like a 3-node cluster, you can just decommission the VMs. And that's not, it's not difficult to do from the Azure portal. But once you've kind of once you've got your VMs up and running, either way that you decide to provision them, then you're going to use Ops Center to actually deploy Cassandra. So I mentioned Ops Center. This is kind of what Ops Center looks like, which I'm sure that's terrible on this projector right now. But Ops Center is basically a tool from DataStax for monitoring and management of your cluster. So like this is a dashboard where I can actually see like statistics on what's going on, like what are my read latencies, my write latencies, what's the read and write traffic, how full are my disks, like how full are my nodes, that kind of stuff. And it also has some stuff where you can set up alerts and all kinds of cool tools that kind of run, that can run in the background and kind of help you keep track of your Cassandra cluster. It's also really super easy to deploy Cassandra from here. So once you've got VMs spun up, there's this screen here, the Create Cluster screen, which you would be able to see if this was slightly larger. But basically, all you have to do is give it a list of IP addresses and then Linux username and passwords, like the sudo passwords, essentially. And it will go and and it will actually go and deploy Cassandra on all those nodes. And you get to pick which, if you want to deploy regular Cassandra, like open source, if you want to deploy DataStax Enterprise, it's like in a dropdown. You pick it from a dropdown, tell it IP addresses, click a button, and it goes. It's also super easy to add nodes, so you basically get a screen that looks exactly like that to add more nodes to your cluster. So if you need to scale out because all of a sudden you have the world's most popular application, remember, you add more nodes, you can add more throughput. You add more nodes, you can also store more data with Cassandra. So super easy to add nodes. Again, it's just like adding, basically you give it a list of IP addresses and it will go out and install it for you. So last thing to kind of talk about as far as Cassandra goes is distribution. So picking a distribution, how do you decide? Cassandra is an Apache project. It's a top-level Apache project. It's been one since, I think, 2010. And so open source available at cassandra.apache.org. If you want to hack on Cassandra, you just kind of want some easy thing to little play around with, it'll be all the bleeding edge sort of features, like the latest and greatest stuff. If you need support, so you'll file JIRA tickets if you have bugs, or there's a mailing list and an IRC channel, both of which the Cassandra community is really great and typically very responsive. So if you have issues, that's where you'll go to get support. So if you want to, absolutely grab open source version of Cassandra. It is available. There's also DataStax Enterprise. So I work for DataStax. We do a commercial distribution of Cassandra. So it's basically core open source Cassandra plus a whole bunch of other stuff that's really nice. So if you ever have used Solr, so if you want to do multi-data center Solr integration where maybe you've got a search problem on top of your Cassandra data, you might use DataStax Enterprise. If you want Spark, so anybody know Spark? Like it's like the new hotness in analytics right now. Probably going to replace Hadoop at some point. Like, I mean, Hadoop will take forever to die, but it's sort of taking over. It's a processing framework for doing not just batch jobs, but stream processing. You get that sort of integrated on top of your Cassandra cluster. You get enterprise security. You get a whole bunch of other sort of extra stuff around core open source Cassandra. It also tends to lag behind the open source version, so it's not like the latest bleeding edge stuff. It's more focused on stable releases. It gets extra QA. You also get a support contract, of course. Like you get, somebody you can call on the phone if something goes wrong. It's also free for startups. So if any of you are in startups and you qualify, if you have less than $3 million of revenue or less than $30 million in funding, there's no limits to the number of nodes you can have. You can have DataStax Enterprise for free and run it on as many nodes as you want. You could run 75,000 like Apple if you wanted to, for example.
Does the startup version have support?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And if you're interested, go to datastax.com. There's a link on our homepage. Or find the slides later. Okay, so just some parting thoughts, and I can't believe we got through that quick. Awesome. So spending time re-architecting your application doesn't add a whole lot of business value. So you need to start thinking, are there things that I could do now to maybe plan for the future, to kind of put myself in a better position for when my application does become super popular, because everybody thinks that their application is going to, that will help you sort of scale in the future. If the idea of sharding and replication and all this other stuff doesn't really appeal to you on a certain level, I definitely encourage you to check out Cassandra. It's a totally different way of kind of doing this sort of stuff. If you want to learn more, planetcassandra.org is your place for like all things Apache Cassandra. So use cases, like who's using it, what are they using it for, links to drivers, blog with all kinds of articles about stuff that's going on in the Cassandra community. Check that out. Datastax.com if you want to learn more about DataStax Enterprise or Ops Center, which I showed you the screenshot of. There's also a tool called Dev Center. So if you're a developer and you're used to like having a really nice GUI for like kind of exploring, what are my tables and what are the columns in the tables, like SQL Server Management Studio or Toad or one of those other tools like that you have for relational databases. That's what Dev Center is. It's totally free. So you can grab that from our website as well. And then azure.microsoft.com. Go there, sign up for a free trial. Grab the Killer Video app if you're interested in like kind of seeing how some Azure services get used and whatnot. That's also a good place to go as well. So if you're just doing this like for local development, and let's say you've got like a CSV file or something like that, pretty dead simple to do. So you can do it with Dev Center, the tool that I mentioned, you can do it with Dev Center. You can also do it with CQLSH, which is the command line like REPL that ships with Cassandra. If you're doing something in production though, you kind of want to do like production import of data. We actually, somebody on our team just released sort of a bulk CSV data loader. It's written in Java, it's open source. If you're gonna be loading from another data system, like say you wanna take data from Oracle and move it into Cassandra, two things I would tell you. One, I would probably do that with a Spark job. So Spark has connectors to not just Cassandra, but also plenty of other relational databases as well, where you could kind of create a Spark job that pulls the data out of one and dumps it into the other. The other thing I'd tell you is if you're trying to move from like an Oracle or a SQL Server to Cassandra, don't just pick up your schema and think that you can drop it into Cassandra. Like, it is so different when it comes to data modeling and stuff. One of the biggest mistakes that we see people make is they'll think, oh, look, CQL, it looks exactly like SQL. Like, I can just, you know, pick up my SQL statements and move them over here, and I have to change a few data types, and, you know, it all works, and now I get all this availability and all this other great stuff. And that's not, like, I mean, that's like setting yourself up for failure. So definitely, like, learn about data modeling and stuff like that and how it's different from relational databases before you go to move your data, if you're moving from, like, a relational database. That's a good question. I think it really depends on, you know, a sort of use case by use case example. So, you know, it's not like a one-to-one comparison, because a lot of times in Cassandra, for example, you're going to be doing a lot of denormalization to support queries. So you might need more machines than you will, you know, if you're just running a, you know, a single SQL Server database. But Cassandra is also going to be able to run on commodity hardware, as opposed to, you know, if you've got a SQL Server database, you might be scaling this way and running on more and more expensive stuff. And it really is just going to depend so much on your workload and your use case. And, you know, I can't tell you that for sure Cassandra is cheaper, you know, like three nodes of Cassandra is cheaper than, you know, 500 gigabytes of SQL Server or anything like that. Something that you would have to, you know, on a case-by-case basis, take a look at. I know that's not a great answer, but I wish there was like a hard and fast rule for it. So not ORMs in the sense of like Hibernate or nHibernate if you're from .NET, or Entity Framework if you're from .NET also. More micro ORMs than big heavyweight ORMs. So for example, in the C# drivers, so like one of the cool things about my job now is that I get to spend about half my time, or maybe a little less than half my time coding still, but I get to do all open source stuff now. And so I created an object mapper for the C# driver that sat on top of the C# driver, and it was very lightweight, similar to Dapper, NPoker, or some of these other micro ORMs for C#. There's similar stuff for the other drivers as well. And so like CQL Poker, the project I created, actually just got pulled back into the driver and is now like the official mapper component in the driver. Same thing with CQL Engine, which is for Python, which another guy on my evangelist team wrote. It was his open source project. And then the Java driver has a mapper as well. I'm pretty sure the Ruby driver has a mapper. Maybe the only one that doesn't right now. Node and probably PHP, because that one's brand new. Like, it's in beta right now. So, yep. But most of the drivers do have like very simple object mappers, yeah. So you don't have to write like a lot of boilerplate code. Yep. It just so the question was: do updates are just, you said inserts and updates are the same thing, basically. Like, updates are just writes. Does it do it optimistically? So because Cassandra doesn't do a read before write, there's like no locking or anything like that's going on. So remember, when you do a write in Cassandra, everything gets a timestamp. So if I were to do two competing writes like around the same time, whichever one basically had the latest timestamp, whichever one got the latest timestamp would be the one that wins. And so that would be the value that would essentially, you know, be the one that gets written, you know, or that it ends up being the one that's, you know, the current state. So it is there for uniqueness, yes. It's also for locality. So for example, we said the first part of the primary key is the partition key, and that determines which node essentially we have to go talk to. Now, there's no constraint in that, in the sense that, I don't know if you can insert, can you do a null partition key? Like, could you insert a null as the partition key? I don't think so, because you wouldn't be able to hash it. So, yeah. So there's constraint, I guess, in that sense, but there's no, when I say no constraint, like, there's no, hey, that value already exists, or there's no idea of foreign key constraints. So like, hey, this, you know, this column in this table points at that column over here, and, you know, we need to make sure that when we insert a record here, that it's pointing at a record that actually exists over there. And does that make sense? Like, you know what I mean? So the question was, how easy is it, like, if I get the schema wrong, or I get it right in version 1, but all of a sudden the requirements change, or I realize I got to query something a different way or whatever, and stuff has to change in version two, basically. So you can absolutely do alter table and things like that. Like Cassandra has an alter table syntax, so if you need to add a new column or something like that, not hard to do. And it's not like it is with like a relational database where a lot of times, especially like if you're dropping a column or something like that, that tends to like lock the table or lock the, like you never do those on a production system if you've ever worked with relational. It's just a metadata change in Cassandra under the covers, so that just has to get propagated around. So it's a pretty lightweight sort of operation. If you actually need to create a new table and maybe denormalize into a new table because, hey, you've got this new way you need to query things and you need to get like your existing data out and put it into a new table, that's not, like, that feature isn't built into core Cassandra itself. I can't do like a create table as select like I can in a relational database. That's where you would do something like Spark, for example, to pick your data up out of one table, drop it into another table. And it's really, really simple to do a job like that. Or if you don't want to write a Spark job in Scala or in Python, you could absolutely, it's so easy to do that with just, you could write a little console app that would probably do it in, you know, depending on how much data you had, but you could probably write a console app like that in about 10 minutes, you know, to pick data up and put it into a new table. So first thing I'd tell you is if you have small data or medium data and you don't have like high availability requirements, then, I mean, don't switch to Cassandra just for the sake of switching. Like, you know, if you need the high availability or you need the multiple data centers or, or you have data that's going to grow beyond the size of one machine and you don't want to have to scale up, that's when you should start thinking about using Cassandra. Like, don't switch just for the sake of switching. Like, I tell people this all the time. It's like, use the right tool for the job. If you got small data, like Postgres or SQL Server or whatever, it's totally fine. Like, use that. That's what it's for, you know? It's hard to say. The reason I say it depends is because, you know, you could say 25, 30 million rows and, you know, like, those rows could be, like, 3 integer columns, or those rows could be, you know, 20 integer columns, or those rows could be 20 text blob columns, or, you know, like, it really just depends on the size of your rows, the size of your data as far as, you know, like, size on disk, that kind of thing. Like, you know, is it all be able to fit on one machine? Like, it's really hard to know the answer to that question. Cassandra is really, really good at ingesting lots of data really quickly, and, you know, its data model is really good at reading data, you know, back out efficiently if you're doing the denormalization and stuff like that, right? So it can be faster than a relational database in some cases. If you're using really high consistency levels, for example, you're going to introduce a lot of latency because you're going to have a lot of nodes talking to each other, you know, waiting for responses to come back from the other nodes to make sure that, you know, the data got written to the replicas. So maybe if you're using high consistency level, you'll get worse performance. You know, it really depends. It totally depends on your use case. I wish there was like a, yes, Cassandra is going to solve all of your problems, but, you know, I'd encourage you to try it out. Like, you know, it's really easy to get up and running, especially if you have SQL knowledge. It's really easy to get up and running with SQL to load some data in there, like take a sample data dump, you know, as a CSV file out of your SQL Server database or whatever, and load it into Cassandra and try running some queries and see, you know, hey, how does this thing perform?